We are family, and I'm calling all of my sisters and my brothers. We are getting together this November, and I can't wait to see every single one of you. That's right, you all. The OA Vision for You convention is happening this fall. That's right, like November, people. November 7th, 8th, and 9th. This year, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, a weekend packed with dynamic speakers, breakout sessions, 500 and plus of your family, your OA family that can't wait to see you. Recovery that you feel the moment you walk into the lobby. Where? At the Liberty International Airport Marriott in Newark, New Jersey. That's right. Newark, New Jersey, you've flown through there. Now come and stay there. Is the cost keeping you away? Listen, we know all the excuses. There are none because we have an answer to every single one. Go to our website, www.avisionforyou.info. That's A-V-I-S-I-O-N, the number 4-Y-O-U.info. For all the information you need. For example, maybe you want to share a ride, help change someone's life. Remember what a godsend those first meetings were? Give that gift to someone else. Share a ride, share a room, consider what that gift will do. Still looking for financial assistance? Well, guess what? Based on the generosity of many, we now have a scholarship fund. You can contact Ken P. at 434-960-8105, 434-960-8105. Remember, this meeting is recorded. You can go back and get that number. Still feeling nervous, scared, don't have a sponsor yet, still struggling? Oh my gosh, we got you. You are not alone. All you need is a little willingness. We'll meet you where you are. We've saved you a seat right up front. And look out for Amy G, because I'm going to give you one squishy, big old hug. But seriously, not a computer person. We'll meet you exactly where you are. There's a phone number on the website. Call us. We'll walk you through registration, because this weekend is all about solutions, and we don't want anything to stand in the way of you coming and finding recovery. Recovery, recovery. We go deeper, we learn a lot, we cry, we laugh, and we recover. We have more to give and more recovery to live. So register now, again, at www.avisionforyou.info. Come and join us. Come home to your OA family. We will be watching for you. And with that, I will pass.
Thank you, Amy G, and good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Leah, and I'm a recovered compulsive overeater in New Jersey and your moderator for today. Today is Sunday, September 7th, 2025. The share ID numbers for Friday, September 5th, are the following: for the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,757, that's 22757. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,758, that's 22758. This morning, A Vision for You presents The Nature of the Problem, the Doctor's Opinion. The doctor's opinion is the foundation of the whole book of Alcoholics Anonymous and of the entire AA fellowship. This section may simply seem to be a helpful introductory note, but without it, the entire book doesn't make sense. The Big Book's approach to step one is what Dr. William Silkworth, the doctor who wrote the two letters found in the doctor's opinion, called the double whammy. Put simply, we have an allergy of the body, which means that once we start eating certain kinds of foods, we have cravings which overpower us. And we have a mental obsession, which means that even if we stop eating those foods, our mind persuades us that we can return to eating those foods all over again, and again, and again, and again. With us today to speak about the doctor's opinion and the nature of our problem is Stephen G., a recovered compulsive overeater from Toronto, Canada. Stephen is dedicated to our 12-step way of life and to carrying the message of recovery. And it's with great appreciation that I welcome Stephen G. to the line. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Leah. Thank you for that gracious introduction, and thank you for the soundtrack introduction. Love the music. That was great. So my name is Stephen G. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater in Toronto, Canada. And my talk today is going to be on the nature of the problem, the doctor's opinion. And I chose this because, as Leah said, this was the foundation of the Big Book. Everything that comes after it is based on what we read in the doctor's opinion. And it's impossible to solve a problem unless you understand what its nature is. And if we have the wrong understanding of the nature of the problem, we'll apply the wrong solution and we'll get no results, which is essentially what I did for most of my life. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about me. I'll tell you about how I eventually came around to study my problem, compulsive overeating. I'm going to talk about why the doctor's opinion is important. I'll share a bit about Silkworth, and then we're going to go into this chapter, and we're going to look at different aspects of it. And along the way, I'll try to incorporate in some of my experience that relates to that. So for me, I've been in Overeaters Anonymous for, I think, about 15 plus years. I came into the program desperate, no solution to the problem. I thought my problem was weight. My weight had fluctuated between 160 pounds and 300 pounds plus until I came into Overeaters Anonymous at the age of 37. I had gained and lost 50 pounds many, many, many times using the solutions that I was aware of. Dieting, restricting, exercising, hiring a nutritionist, getting a gym membership, et cetera, et cetera. But I'd always come back to the same point, back out of control. In the first 3 years of Overeaters Anonymous, I sort of picked and choose what I would do. And I had relapse after relapse after relapse. They got worse and worse and worse. And I experienced lots of the indignities of compulsive overeating, and I'll share a few of them as we go through this reading. Eventually, I got abstinence about 12 years ago, but it wasn't. It was a heck of a lot better than where I was before, but it didn't feel completely stable until I came across a crowd of people who were studying the Big Book, and they seemed different. They described themselves as recovered. They were much more peaceful, consistently peaceful, and they described themselves as recovered, and they didn't spend much time talking about food. They spent more time talking about the solution, and I was drawn to that. And once I started studying this book, everything became simplified. The nature of the problem became quite simplified. The nature of the solution became quite simplified. You know, the problem is we have an allergy of the body, an obsession of the mind, and it's permanent and it's progressive, and in my case, it will be fatal. The last binge I had was so out of control, so socially isolating, so physically uncomfortable, so emotionally uncomfortable that there really would be no solution for me besides suicide. And thank God I found this spiritual solution. And I've had a steady body weight for the last, you know, more than a decade. And my life is, I lead a normal life one day at a time, so long as I follow certain simple instructions. And more than the physical part, I'm a much more peaceful, happy person. So that's how I came across the AA Big Book. And the doctor's opinion really helped to solidify my understanding of the nature of the problem. And why is this important? We learn later on in the book that self-knowledge avails us nothing. Understanding the disease will not solve the problem, but it'll help me to realize that I'm hopeless. And that was an essential part of my recovery. I needed to realize I was hopeless. It also helps me to accept. Prior to this, I thought I was weak-willed, you know, lazy, et cetera. But it helped me to understand, particularly the part about the allergy of the body, that I was different. And so it explained why I can't compare myself to my friends. I can't compare myself to my family. They didn't have this disease. And there was a lot of self-acceptance that came with that. And then I could direct my efforts. We can direct our efforts towards the real solution, rather than trying to direct our efforts to the solution that doesn't work, which is using willpower. The other thing that Silkworth's letter did is it gave credibility to this book. This is a well-known, well-respected physician. And Silkworth started to understand the problem, but he didn't have a solution. But he witnessed the solution in one of his patients, which did not come from Silkworth, and he had the humility to recognize it and to encourage it and to support it. And so we who have recovered owe a debt of gratitude to him. So let's look at this gentleman named Dr. Silkworth. Who was he? What did he do and what did he experience? Silkworth was a neurologist and a psychiatrist in Depression era New York, in the early 1930s. And he worked at a place called the Towns Hospital, which was a hospital devoted to the treatment of people with problems with alcoholism and addiction. And I believe I've read somewhere that this was not his first choice for a job, but it was depression era. And so there was difficulty finding work. And he took this job and surprisingly became quite devoted to the care of these people with problems with alcohol and addiction. And at the time, the prevailing understanding of alcoholism or addiction was that people are weak-willed or they're of low moral character, et cetera. And Silkworth, with time, began to see that actually that's simply not the case. He began to see that there were a certain small percentage of people who came to that hospital who kept coming back over and over again. And no matter what the doctors and staff did there, they could not help them. And so he witnessed their gradual decline. And he realized these people were a separate entity. These were the people with alcoholism. And he slowly started to piece this together, that this was actually an illness with two parts. allergy of the body, and an obsession of the mind. Later on in the Big Book, we're going to see the definitions of people who struggle with alcohol, but not everybody is an alcoholic. In the chapter, there is a solution. It talks to us about people who are moderate drinkers, or people who are heavy drinkers, but they're not real alcoholics. And in similar comparison, we can talk about people who are moderate eaters or heavy eaters, but not compulsive overeaters. And many of these people that Silkworth saw at Towns Hospital were these moderate drinkers or heavy drinkers. With enough motivation, with enough help from medical personnel, they would respond and they would get better and they would stop drinking. But these alcoholics, there was absolutely nothing that Silkworth could do. And then in the course of Silkworth's work there, he came across a patient named Bill W. Bill W. is one of the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Bill had 4 admissions to the hospital over the course of, I think it's 1933 and 1934, and each getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And Silkworth helped to explain to him the nature of the problem, but Silkworth didn't have a solution. And in the course of one of Bill's admissions to hospital, he came into contact with some members of the Oxford group, who were a spiritual group that were practicing what was called first century Christianity. And this was kind of the origin of the 12 steps. And he had a spiritual experience, and Silkworth witnessed this, and it overwhelmed him. He'd never seen anything like this before. And he wrote a letter that he gave to the early AA members that they put in this book. And the letter says following. So, to whom it may concern, I've specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. So this is this word that we hear over and over in the Big Book. They appear to have recovered, returned to a state of normalcy, so long as they do follow certain simple steps one day at a time. And then he goes on to say, these facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. Then later on page XXVIII, I'm going to bounce around a little bit here. On page XXVIII, he talks about his experience of working with alcoholics when he did not have a solution. And he says, if any feel that a psychiatrist directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us while on the firing line. See the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments. And the most cynical will accept and encourage this movement. We feel, after many years of experience, that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. So he's talking here not about the majority of patients he's seeing at this hospital. The majority of them fall into the category of the moderate or the heavy, able to help them. But these people, he simply cannot help. They're a separate entity. They have an illness that's permanent, progressive, and fatal. And when we look at that paragraph, we can see the progression of the illness, and certainly in my life. I came into the program thinking my problem was with weight, but as I got more and more recovery, I started to see that the problem was so much deeper than that. And over the course of my illness, my life contracted. It became smaller, 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 smaller. Yes, I got more and more physically uncomfortable, obese, but emotionally, I got worse and worse, socially isolated worse and worse. And I don't think I even had a full grasp of the degree to which that illness was gradually taking away my life. And Silkworth has observed it, and he has absolutely no solution for it. So Silkworth's description of the nature of the problem. He identified that this was a two-part illness. And his main contribution was the first part, the body part. He acknowledges and touches on the mental obsession. That gets discussed a lot more as we go through the book in the chapter more about alcoholism. But he recognizes there is a problem with the body of the alcoholic. There is a problem with the body of the compulsive overeater. Once an alcoholic or a compulsive overeater is exposed to an alcoholic food ingredient or behavior, it produces a very abnormal physical response. It's called an allergy, but allergy just simply means an abnormal response to something. Like a switch is flipped and we are no longer in control. And we can't control how much we're going to consume, and we can't control how long it will last. And we can't control what the consequences will be. It produces the phenomenon of craving. It's just escalation, acceleration, augmentation, just increases, and makes us a separate entity. If that was the only problem, then simply stop exposing our bodies to those foods, ingredients, and behaviors. But that's not the only problem. The real problem, the second problem, centers in our mind, which is a mental obsession, twist of the mind. No matter how much damage those foods, ingredients, eating behaviors has caused, and no matter how much time has gone between when we were last exposed to them, our minds will tell us it's a good idea, it will make you feel better, and we start again. The allergy gets triggered, an onslaught of craving, and we're out of control again and again. So Silkworth describes this body problem and the mind problem. He also gives us a description of what happens to an addict, alcoholic, compulsive overeater in abstinence. And we're going to come back to that because that's an important point, because there's a lot of focus within the fellowship on the idea of abstinence. And of course, abstinence is important, but it's not enough. And the truth is abstinence creates a whole other problem of its own, and we're going to see what that is, and Silkworth's going to describe it to us really well. So the first part of the problem, the body problem, the physical allergy, this was a stunning piece of information for me. I would never have, I wouldn't have ever received this information outside of these rooms, because it seems like such a bizarre concept, particularly when it relates to food. How is it possible that once I start, I can't stop? But it was a key piece of information and allowed me to forgive myself, accept myself. So we look at a few statements that Silkworth makes. We'll go to page XXVIII. And he says, "We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. But the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve." So the action of alcoholic foods, ingredients, behaviors on a compulsive overeater is a manifestation of an allergy. These allergic types can never safely use these foods, ingredients, or behaviors in any form at all. Key piece of information. Then he goes on to say, at the bottom of the page, "Men and women drink essentially because they like the effects produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. For them, their alcoholic life seems to be the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. Men and women eat their or use their alcoholic foods, ingredients, and behaviors essentially because they like the effect produced by them. The effect that sugar, sweeteners, certain other ingredients produce on me is so elusive that I can't admit that it's bad for me. I can't differentiate the true from the false. All I remember is those first 10 seconds of pleasure. And I don't realize that other people don't get those. That they might like it, but they don't get that heightened sense of pleasure that produces this immediate sense of ease and comfort. And that's what I get drawn back to over and over and over. Or behaviors. Behaviors for me were eating between planned meals. Didn't matter what I ate. That produces an ease and comfort, a pleasurable experience. And then the phenomenon of craving. Volume, eating beyond certain volumes of food produces a heightened sensation that I forget is injurious, but it produces the allergy of the body, phenomenon of craving, and I begin the process of becoming out of control. And with time and with the help of others, I was able to recognize that there were certain ingredients and behaviors, they would produce a phenomenon of craving immediately. So I was out of control. And there were others that would do it a little bit more gradually, but eventually I'd be out of control. And so I had to realize that those, I could not safely use those and become willing to let go of them. This helps me to understand why why I would repeatedly end up in my apartment in the dark by myself, physically so uncomfortable, surrounded by candy wrappers, swollen face, painful mouth, no comfortable position, and hating myself and hating everybody else. Why would I do that? This was the question I had for myself. Why would I do that? Why do I do that? What's wrong with me? Well, now I understand. Once I start, I can't stop. And it doesn't matter what the consequences will be. I'm now a robot and will continue this until I'm almost dead. Very useful, very useful piece of information. Even more words from Silkworth on this. We'll go to page XXIX. And he says, at the bottom of the page, they took a drink a day or so prior to the date. And then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. The switch gets flipped. We become a robot. We have no idea when this is going to end and what the consequences are going to be. And then a final statement from Silkworth on this, if we go to page XXX, and he says here, all these and many others, see, before this statement, he gives a sort of survey of the type of personalities he's encountered with this disease of alcoholism. And in the end, none of that matters. What matters is the thing that is in common to them, that all these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. So all these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start using their alcoholic foods, ingredients, and behaviors without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people, sets them apart as a distinct entity. And many of us, I suspect all of us who've recovered here in Overeaters Anonymous, Vision for You, needed to see and recognize we were a distinct entity. And the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. We'll come back to that. So, allergy of the body, once we start, we can't stop. And we have no idea where it's going to end And in some cases, the phenomenon of craving may be immediate, but in others, it may be gradual. But eventually, we have to come to the conclusion that we have to entirely abstain from all of them in order to recover. Second part of the problem of the mind, the mental obsession, the twist of the mind. No matter how much damage these foods, ingredients, behaviors have done to my life, no matter how many times I've gained 50 pounds, lost 50 pounds, no matter how many indignities, no matter how many times I've lost lots of weight and been so proud of it, and then run into people I hadn't seen for a year who last saw me when I'd lost the weight, and now I'm back to my previous weight, and the look on their faces, no matter how many times I develop sores between my thighs from my legs rubbing together, no matter how many times I couldn't sit in the plane seat, couldn't do my belt buckle, no matter how many times I kept coming back to that, my mind, which I thought was well functioning, would always tell me it's a good idea to go back to those foods, ingredients, and behaviors. So Silkworth says in page XXIX, let's see, where is that? So he says, again, I think we've read part of this, but we're going to apply it to the mental obsession. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I've had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal, which was to be settled on a certain date, favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. A really good description of the mental obsession. Makes no difference what important things happen. The mental obsession comes and it says it's a good idea. We believe it. It's helped me to explain why a few years ago I was invited to, in the type of work that I do, I was invited to speak at this conference in Europe. And it was kind of at a time where my weight was close to its peak, and I had maybe one or two pairs of clothes that I could wear. And a few days before, I went on a binge, a binge of all binges, and then couldn't fit into my clothes and had to wear a pair of pants that had a stain on them. And I gave this talk and I tried to position myself so that people couldn't see the stain. People came up to me afterwards, asked me questions, and I look back on that, and it's just stunning. My life is so different now, but it helps me to explain why a person that seems otherwise normal would do something like that. Because I was mentally ill, and I am mentally ill, but able to live a normal, recovered life by the grace of God and this program and this book. So, again, Silkworth comes back to this point on page XXVIII, and he says, and we've read this before, but we're going to read it again as it applies to the mental obsession. They cannot, so at the bottom of the page, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. I cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. I couldn't differentiate that for me to start eating those foods that produce the phenomenon of craving 2 days before I was supposed to give an important talk. I could not differentiate whether that was good or bad. It's funny now. It really is funny. It's not funny when you're into it. And I'm sure there's people who are struggling out there. It's probably not funny to them. But for me now, looking at it now that I've recovered, it's comical. And we have to laugh. Then Silkworth goes on and he says, and this is again on page XXIX. He says, I believe we read this already. one second here to find it. Yeah, basically after they've succumbed to the desire again, as so many do. Just give me one second, I'm on the wrong page. Here we go. Top of XXIX, after they have succumbed to the desire again, so the mental obsession again, yeah, it's a good idea to eat those foods, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, so the switch is flipped now, I become a robot, I don't know how much I'm going to eat, I don't know when it's going to end, I don't know what the consequences will be. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, I will never eat those foods again, with a firm resolution, never to drink again, never eat those foods again. And this is repeated over and over. Unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's little hope for his recovery. I couldn't tell you the number of times I repeated that over and over before I came to Overeaters Anonymous. I mean, I don't know, hundreds of times I said to myself, that's it, I'm never doing that again. Within OA, three times for sure that I said, I'm never doing that again. And then proceeded to go on a binge that led me where it always leads me, which is into my room in the dark, lying in the bed, wanting to kill myself. And then the final part on the mental obsession, this is again on page XXVIII, if I can find it. Right. And these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, can never safely use their alcoholic foods, ingredients, behaviors in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. I thought my problem was weight. But as I began to recover and began to clean up the wreckage of my past and the wreckage of my life was a mess. And I kept people at bay. So I had a margin around me. I kept people at a distance to protect this mess because I was so embarrassed of it, or embarrassed about it. My house or my apartment was a mess. My car was a mess, packed with papers. My finances were a mess. My relationships, keeping in touch with people, were a mess. I hadn't responded to emails for weeks, months, et cetera, et cetera. And I can relate to this idea. Their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Couldn't solve them until I recovered. So talked about the mind. Sorry, we talked about the body. And we've talked about the mind. Our body's abnormal. Physical allergy of the body, once we start, we can't stop. Mental obsession, twist of the mind. Whenever we stop, inevitably, we will start again. And this cycle will go on and on and on until our lives are over by various means. And I'm quite confident in my disease of compulsive overeater, that will be suicide. I can't tolerate it. It's so physically, emotionally uncomfortable. Allergy of the body, obsession of the mind, two parts. Permanent, progressive, fatal, in various ways. So what was Silkworth's solution? Well, he didn't have one. he was a very, very compassionate, very kind man. And he was able to help those moderate and heavy users of alcohol, moderate and heavy users of food. I'm sure there's people within the fellowship who are moderate, heavy users who get benefit from plan of eating, get benefit from the fellowship. But that wasn't enough for me. So Silkworth wouldn't have had a solution for me. His solution was entire abstinence. But he recognized that that actually wasn't enough. And in fact, abstinence produces another problem, which is our real problem, which is the reason why these alcoholics drink, which is the reason why I eat compulsively. And I'm going to look first at his solution. And he says on page XXVII, one second here. I can't remember the exact page, but it says the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. It doesn't say sort of abstinence. It says entire abstinence, not a little bit of alcohol, but no alcohol at all. If we have the allergy of the body, we no longer have the option, entire abstinence. And we now recognize that as the first part of the solution, but it's not the only solution. Because Silkworth recognizes that as soon as the alcohol is stopped, the real problem is revealed, which is we become restless, irritable, and discontent. So he talks in his doctor's opinion a number of different occasions where people come into the hospital and they get relief from the physical phenomenon. So brief withdrawal, removal of the alcohol, and people feel better. And that would happen to me also, where my binges would just, the early binges, not the later ones, the early binges would max out, reach their peak, I'm miserable, I hate this, okay, I'm going to stop. And I'll stop for a few days, I feel a little bit better. But what happens is that life begins to bother me. It doesn't really matter what's happening in life, whether everything is perfect or everything is not. I will become restless, which is 1930s language for nervous, worried, frightened about anything. I'll become irritable, which is 1930s language for angry, mad. And I'll become discontent, which is 1930s language for depressed, sad, moody, which essentially, now that I look back on my life, describes my whole life. And that's the real problem. And in that state, that's really fertile ground for the mental obsession, which says, you know what will make you feel better? You know what will give you immediate sense of ease and comfort? Why don't you eat something? Why don't you eat one of these? And then the allergy will be triggered. See that abstinence actually is not the solution. It can't be, because it creates a whole new problem. But what we learned, what Silkworth learned from Bill Wilson, is that the solution to that is a spiritual experience. And that removes that restlessness, irritability, discontentedness one day at a time, and removes the mental obsession. And so we can lead a normal life one day at a time, a recovered life. But it requires that we do certain simple things that the book talks about. So abstinence is not the solution. Once we become abstinent, we must get through to that spiritual experience quickly. Quickly, quickly, quickly. As one of our fellows says, like our hair is on fire. So for Silkworth, much like we who have recovered, recognized his powerlessness. He did not have a solution. So he was at step one in terms of being a physician. He was powerless over alcoholism, powerless over compulsive overeating, in exactly the same way we are, and he had the humility to admit it. And if we look at page XXIX, he says here, men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal. Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop. But I cannot. You must help me. He also says, Silkworth also says, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. Meaning that for the moderate eater, heavy eater, people who don't have the actual allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind, but maybe doing a bit much where it's affecting their health, affecting their life, frothy emotional appeal may suffice. Please stop. Please stop. You're hurting your family. You're hurting your work. You're hurting your health. You're going to die. Frothy emotional appeal may suffice. For a person who has the allergy of the body, the obsession of the mind, that's permanent, progressive, and fatal, no amount of appeal, regardless how emotional, from anyone, spouse, children, doctor, fellow, sponsor, will suffice. Silkworth also goes on to say, among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. The general opinion seems to be that most compulsive overeaters are doomed. They're going to die. So this is Silkworth's thinking. Until one of his patients is brought the solution. And interestingly enough, he's brought the solution by way of another doctor, who was Dr. Carl Jung, who was going to be talked about in the chapter, There is a Solution. He brings the solution to one of Bill W.'s former acquaintances, who then gives it to one of Bill W.'s friends, who brings it to Bill W., which is the solution is spiritual. Bill Wilson follows the instructions of the Oxford group at the day of the day, which were the predecessor to the 12 steps, and he has a spiritual experience that expels the mental obsession. And Silkworth has known him for several admissions where he's to hospital, where he's absolutely hopeless. And Silkworth sees this. He's never seen it before. And he is overwhelmed by it. And he has the humility to encourage it and to give it his stamp of approval, because he sees its effectiveness. He starts to see it work in others. And he ultimately says, what is the solution? Prior to this, he had no solution. After his interaction with Bill Wilson and seeing the effects of this program on other alcoholics, he says on page XXI, top of the page, what is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. He doesn't say, perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my treatments. Or I can best answer this by relating to you what I did. He says, I can best answer this by relating to you what I saw, what I felt, which was essentially the power of God. And we'll read what he experienced. About 1 year prior, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had but partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. So Silkworth here doesn't say he accepted the plan outlined by his doctors, or he accepted the plan outlined by the hospital. He says he accepted the plan outlined in this book, which was written by the first 100 recovered alcoholics. And he went out and he followed the plan. 1 year later, he called to see me and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. We now know that that's God-reliance. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. And then we'll look at the last line on the next page, which says, I earnestly advise every alcoholic or compulsive overeater to read this book through. And though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. I'm very grateful to Silkworth because if it wasn't for this book and his explanation of the nature of the problem, which is simple, and communicated this to Bill Wilson so that Bill Wilson could put together the problem and the solution and then carry the message on to other alcoholics who then carried it on to compulsive overeaters like me, I would have no solution. And when we go back to that previous page where it says, from a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck, you know, that's what I was like my last relapse. Angry wreck with no solution. It would have just ended in my apartment, in my room in the dark, with me probably committing suicide. But I've been returned to a state of normalcy that's better than the life I had before because I'm in a healthy body weight. But in addition to that, it's much more than that because my life is no longer contingent on externals. So long as I follow a few simple steps, which are the 12 steps, I can have a degree of peace and serenity and happiness regardless of what's going on in my life. And it's not that my life is perfect, but it's much, much better than it was. And it's hard for us, I think, as recovered people to fully appreciate how much we've changed, but we can see it in how it's reflected back to us from other people in our lives that we're just so different. And it's because of the humility of people like Dr. Silkworth to admit they don't know what to do and to recognize something that's happening that is beyond their comprehension because of its magnitude, and then to encourage it and to lead from one alcoholic to the next compulsive overeater, next compulsive overeater. And it's given me life that naturally I should not be alive. My life is because of some supernatural thing that's happening that I don't understand, but so long, and it's not important that I understand it. All I need to know is that I'm doomed, and that if I follow a few simple steps, I'm not doomed, and I can actually be quite happy. And then I'm certainly willing to do those things. Not every day. Sometimes I have to I have to force myself. There are times where I don't want to do it, but I'll slip back to that restlessness, irritability, and discontentness, and I know if I allow that to stick around, we know what's going to happen next, and I don't want that to happen. So, yeah, very grateful, and thank you for, Leah, for inviting me to speak. I hope I've shared something that was useful to others. And that's it. With that, I will pass.
Thank you so much, Stephen, for this compelling, thorough teaching and sharing of your personal experience this morning on the nature of the problem found in the doctor's opinion. Thank you so very much. Certainly another treasure for our archives. The CD for this presentation, 22,761. That's 22761 for Stephen's presentation this morning. Stephen's contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording, so do stay tuned for that. We will now transition to a question and answer segment, your opportunity to pose questions. You can do so by pressing star 1 to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name. Questions only, please. I didn't get any of that. Go ahead.
Begin, Maryland. Margaret in Georgia.
Margaret, who's from Maryland?
Judy N. From Maryland.
Okay, thank you, Judy. Gotcha.
Susan.
Margaret D. in Georgia.
Yes, Margaret. And
oh,
I
sorry.
Have you, Pete, as well. That's okay.
Herbert F. in New Mexico.
Herbert, thank you. Thus far, I have Pete B., Margaret D., Judy N., Susan. I'll need your initial, please. Herbert F. Who else?
Jordan L.
Jordan. All right. Well, let's get started with this list, beginning with Pete B. Good morning, Pete.
Good morning, Leah. Thank you for your service. And Stephen, thank you so much for your presentation. It was really well thought out, had depth and weight. So you mentioned that the doctor's opinion says that men and women drink because they like the effect. And you mentioned the effect was ease and comfort. What is it that makes you believe that alcoholics or compulsive overeaters have a heightened sense of ease and comfort as a result of ingesting the substances that trigger the phenomenon of craving versus what everybody else gets?
Hey, Pete. Thanks for the question. Well, I suppose that's just my perception. I don't know any of my friends or family members whose favorite activity would be to be by themselves with food, completely socially isolated, and reading a magazine or a book or watching TV, or that was my desired social activity. And so it's just my perception that I must be getting something more from this than they are. And whether or not that's true, I don't know. But it certainly helps me to understand it if I think of it that way.
Thanks.
Thank you, Pete. Margaret D., your turn.
Thanks, Leah. Thank you so much. That was such a sane presentation. I really appreciated it. I'm kind of following along in Pete's footsteps, but I would just like your opinion. In that same sentence, where the description of the effect that the compulsive eater got, that sense of pleasure, for me, it was not a pleasure, it was a sense of relief. And somehow I misconstrued that relief equaled pleasure. Can you comment, or would you mind commenting on that? I think it's, again, for me, it's just another part of my delusional mind mistaking relief for pleasure. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for your question. I don't know that I don't have the right answer. And to be honest, in the end, I don't think it matters. I think that all I need to know is that it has a positive effect for some reason, whether that's pleasure, relief. I'm sure we could come up with lots of different words, but all I need to know is it does something very abnormal to me. And that's what I needed as the foundation for my recovery. So whether we talk about whether it has a heightened pleasure for me or not, whether it's relief or what, it makes no difference. All I need to know is that I have a very abnormal physical reaction to food. And as a result, I'm a separate entity. And as a result, the first part of the solution is that I have to entirely abstain from those things. And then I have to work the program to the best of my ability to have a spiritual experience so that I can recover and lead a normal life and be useful to others. I hope that's helpful.
That is very helpful. Thank you.
Thanks, Margaret B. Judy N., you're up. Judy N., star one to unmute.
Okay. Good morning, Leah. Thank you for your service. Stephen, thank you for your wonderful, informative presentation. I understand that Dr. Silkworth points out, as you did, that we need entire abstinence, but the solution has to come from a spiritual awakening or a spiritual experience. And because we don't have the power to deal with a mental obsession just on self-knowledge alone, I was wondering exactly how you work your step 11, if you would share that with me. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your question. So just to clarify, the question is, how do I work step 11? Is that correct?
Yes. Which is your prayer and meditation?
Yeah, so I don't... I just follow the instructions in the book. And I try not to get too creative because that often leads me to deviate from the instructions. And so on awakening, I pray. And I try to follow the instructions in the book on awakening.
Are there any specific prayers?
I do the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, the prayer of St. Francis. And I do the part in the step nine where I can't remember the details, but just asking how I can be useful to other fellows today or people who are still suffering in compulsive overeating. And my experience in working with others is that it really doesn't matter. We need to just select prayers that we feel comfortable with, that we like, and that we relate to. The important thing is to be directing our attention to our higher power. And then at night, I review my day as the instructions outline, and I try not to spend too much time. I try to be constructive and not destructive. And then I thank God for the day. And throughout the day, when I'm agitated or doubtful, and this is the harder part, is I just have to be aware of what's going on in my emotional state and then just pause and ask God for the right thought and the right action. That is a work in progress, because that one requires me to be vigilant and to be aware. And then also to the fourth part of step 11 is that when I don't know what to do, when I face indecision, I ask God for an inspiration or an intuitive thought or a decision. And again, that is a challenge because it requires me to be aware, because my default way of thinking is just try to think more. And the book is telling me not to do that. So there's nothing special about the way that I do this. It's by the book, and because it's worked for 100 years. Anytime I try to get creative, I have no particular expertise. Anytime I try to get creative, I deviate from what works. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judy. And next up, Susan. And can you offer your initial, please?
Susan Fay.
Thank you.
Hi. Thanks for sharing. I appreciate it. And I've been around for a while, and I just wanted to, I guess one of the things that kind of got in my way at one time was, like, through doing the steps and putting the food down, I had, remembrances of, like, some very stressful or traumatic incidences. And, wondering what your experience was with this.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. I didn't quite understand. Can you just clarify again?
Okay, by going through the steps and having more clarity, you know, because the food was down, there were things that were coming up in my past that I was remembering, and it was disturbing. So it was hard to, you know, hard to get through, and I went back into the food.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, definitely. And as soon as I put the food down, I'm uncomfortable. Lots of thoughts coming to my head of resentments, regrets, fear, worry, all those things. And I think the book is pretty clear that that's what's going to happen. And but we have a step to that. It's called step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. And that's why it's so essential to get through those steps guided by a recovered fellow quickly. Because I will become uncomfortable very, very quickly. I have no solution to life. And I didn't experience, you know, I think we all have different life experience. I didn't experience tremendous trauma when I was a child. And I think that probably is very challenging for people who put the food down. But the book does not distinguish. The book says everybody can recover, no matter what. But we must put the food down and work through those steps quickly. And there are steps that address those specific concerns you have. And one of the reasons I went into relapse in the past is because I didn't want to do those things. And so I procrastinated. And of course, within a fairly short period of time, I was in relapse. That's the nature of the disease. That's a rule. That will happen. Yeah. I hope that answers your question.
It does. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Susan C. Herbert S., your question, please.
Good morning. This is Herbert S. Thank you so much for your share. I have a question. I don't know that you mentioned it specifically, or and I apologize if it's kind of off topic, but it's something I've always wanted to ask and just kind of curious about is, do you know where the notion came from, or I guess the principle or rule of men working only with men and women only working with women? I'm just awfully curious. I've met people who have that position and hold that line, and I'm just curious if you know where that came from. Thank you so much again.
Thanks, Robert. That's a good question. Well, all I can tell you is my own experience, I think. I've worked with, my first sponsor was a woman. And I have sponsored women, but now I mostly sponsor men. The reason is this is a very intimate process to guide somebody through the steps. And the person who is being sponsored has to feel comfortable sharing everything. And I think that there can be challenges if the person doesn't share things because they feel the other person may not be able to relate, or things get so intimate that boundary lines can become crossed. So I think that's the reason why, but I think everyone is different. I don't think there's any rule. I think everybody is different.
And yeah, I thought maybe that came from the book or the 12 and 12 or something, but maybe it didn't. Maybe the answer is precisely that it is a personal decision. So thanks again. God bless you and everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, Herbert F. Jordan L., your turn. Jordan, star one to unmute.
Hey, good morning, Leah. Can you hear me okay?
I do. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, awesome. My name's Jordan L. I'm grateful to be absent and on a meeting this morning. Thanks. Thank you, Stephen, for sharing with us. It really hit me. You really hit home that abstinence is not the point here. You know, I think sometimes we lose track of that. Just because this is a really tough thing to overcome, compulsive overeating. This isn't an easy process by any means. I guess I have two questions, and really, I'll decide between the two. I think what I want to ask you, you mentioned moderate and heavy eaters, right? That there could even be some in this fellowship, and that generally those are the folks that a plan of eating is enough. It suffices. Or coming in and going to meetings and being a part of the fellowship is enough. That suffices to arrest what it is that they're dealing with, which may not be compulsive overeating. It might be moderate eating or heavy eating, as you referenced, right? And I got to tell you, it took me a long time to understand that. 5 years, as a matter of fact, and lots of like personal experiences to understand the differences between those three. So would you talk a little bit more about your own experience with coming to understand those differences?
Hi, Jordan. Thanks a lot for your comments and your question. Well, I think the most important thing is for me to know that I am the real compulsive overeater. That's the most important thing for me to know. And I came to that conclusion with time. I need entire abstinence, and I need to work these 12 steps to the best of my ability. With respect to other people, all I need to know of it is if somebody else is saying, like, I don't need to do the steps or I don't really need to abstain from everything, then that's fine. There's no musts in the program, but I just know that that can't work for me. That is the most important thing I need to know. But it also helps me, too, when I'm working with others, because I'm going to work with people who are desperate. And so as part of the process of going through the steps, we have to get to the point where that person and I both understand that this person is the real deal compulsive overeater. Otherwise, what's the purpose of this? I'm more useful to somebody else. But it also helps me to accept when people leave the program and they're fine. I've had a few people I've sponsored who, after they've gone through the steps, said, you know what, I decided I'm not a compulsive overeater. I don't try to convince anybody of anything. I say, okay, I'm here if you need me. And maybe some of those people are heavy eaters, that actually they found that they don't really have the allergy of the body, the obsession of the mind. So to answer your question, the most important thing I need to know is that I am a compulsive overeater and I need to entirely abstain. I need a spiritual experience. And then just to be accepting of other people, of what they choose to do, what they choose to work in the program. That's the key. Yeah, I hope that's useful.
Thank you, Jordan. We still have a couple time for a few more questions. If you'd like to pose a question, questions on Rivka, to Stephen, *1 to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name.
Susan S.
Susan S.
Did you get Rivka?
Jeannie B.
I did get you, Rivka. I have Susan. Who else?
Matthew B.
Matthew B.
Jeannie B.
And Jeannie B, if we have time still. Okay, let's get started. Rivka, your question, please.
Okay. Thank you so much, Leah, for your service. And yes, Stephen, thank you so much for that presentation. When you said, you know, I don't know any normal eater whose favorite activity is being by themselves eating and reading, I caught my breath because even though I'm gratefully recovered today, like, I much prefer eating alone and reading. I don't enjoy eating and not reading or eating with others. And my question is that a behavior that you don't allow yourself to do today, or is that still acceptable in your you know, recovery?
Mm. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Rivka. Yeah, that's a good question. When I referenced that, me alone eating, that was back when I was in the disease. Now I don't. So long as I, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with, so long as I'm eating according to my plan of eating, and I'm not triggering the allergy, and I don't have the mental obsession to eat the alcoholic foods and ingredients, then how I choose to eat doesn't really matter much anymore. Whether I choose to sit at the table or sit in front of the TV, or that doesn't matter to me. So I don't find that triggers the allergy. But what I was referencing before is that I just wanted to, you know, I just wanted to get high, basically. Like, I got high from eating, and I wanted something to kind of distract me as well. So I'd have the TV on, and I'm just going on a binge, or I'm out at a fast food restaurant and I don't want to talk to anybody. I just want to enjoy this food, but I want to have a little distraction reading my magazine. Those would be my favorite kind of things to do. So, but in recovery, so long as I'm following my plan of eating and I'm spiritually healthy, I can eat. I mean, I can eat in front of the TV or reading or whatever. It doesn't matter. That's my experience, Rivka. Hope that helps.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rivka R. Susan S., your turn.
Good morning. I actually have a steps question, and I'm not sure if this is the right place to ask it. Could you let me know if that is appropriate?
I will let you know, Susan. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I am new, and I am I hear you saying, and I don't disagree, that it's important to go through the steps quickly, but does that, at the same time, does that require me to not have any kind of picking up at any point in time? If I pick up, do I go back to step one, or what? How does that work?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. Thank you. The doctor's opinion on several occasions mentions that we have to get the alcohol out of our system. It says it in lots of different ways, but that we have to get the alcohol out of our system, or the alcoholic foods, ingredients, behaviors out of our system before we work the steps. Because if the allergy is triggered, spiritual solution can't work. So in the case of, if I talk about me, if I was guiding somebody through the steps, of course, when people start, we start working together. Many people don't know what their alcoholic foods or behaviors are, or have not been able to craft a sane plan of eating. So there's no expectation that somebody's going to put the food down immediately. But before we proceed to step two, the person has to put the food down. Because the program doesn't work if we're still triggering the allergy. And that comes with a caveat that sometimes there in the beginning, there are things that people know for sure, like, this is a problem for me. And there are other foods, behaviors people aren't sure. And it's okay not to be sure. But we'll start by putting down the ones that we know for sure. And then new information may come to light that there's other ingredients that are causing a phenomenon of craving. We have to be willing to put those down eventually. I would suggest you find a recovered sponsor, and if you don't have one already, and proceed with them. But once you start, you don't have to be abstinent, because we're still kind of figuring things out. But before we proceed to step two, and it'll become clear to you once you start working with somebody, we have to put the food down. It doesn't work otherwise. Hope that answers your question.
It does. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Susan S. Next up, Matthew B. Your question, please.
Hi, can I be heard?
Yes.
Thank you. Hi, Matthew B., a grateful member of this group. Thank you for your share. My question is, entire abstinence is not the solution. You talked about your isolation. I'd love for you to elaborate a little bit on the concept of how humans, while no human power could, probably, how does fellowship aid us in our journey to recovery?
Hi, Matthew. Thanks. Yeah, that's a good question. I think simply put, I needed fellows to share the message with me, which was I needed to entirely abstain. And then I needed a recovered fellow to show me how to do that, to guide me through that. And then once I've done that, covered, then I need to constantly be interacting with fellows. Because it reminds me of step 1, 2, and 3. It reminds me that I lack power. But I also need to be interacting with fellows and sharing step 10s and in carrying the message in step 12. So the truth is, if I'm truly working step 1 through 12 the way it's directed in the big book, I will constantly be interacting with fellows. The fellowship is important in the beginning, in particular, because we have no power. Before I've worked through the steps, I don't have any power to stop myself from eating. And so I'll need some support. And so the power of the fellowship, it's not strong enough to keep me abstinent long-term. It's not strong enough to keep me recovered. But there is a power in the fellowship initially that can give me a lot of support as I'm working through the steps. And that's an essential component, I think, of recovery. And that's how I see fellowship. But fellowship alone cannot solve the problem. We can make as many phone calls as we want, go to as many meetings as we want. That will help, but it won't solve the problem. But if we're working the steps as they're directed in this book, there'll be no shortage of fellowship. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew B. And our final question for today comes from Jeannie B.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having this meeting. Hi, Stephen, thank you so much for the share. I heard you say that, Dr. Silkworth says that entire abstinence is, I don't remember the exact wording, but essential. And then I heard some other people in their questions say that you said that abstinence is not the solution. So I also was at World Service and they were saying that somebody said that abstinent, all the other steps are to support us staying abstinent. And I think I would just like your clarification, please, on the role of abstinence in recovery. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, thanks a lot for that question. It's a question I confused me for a long time. But abstinence just means putting down the foods. So not eating the foods that trigger the allergy, not engaging in the eating behaviors that trigger the allergy. But the problem is that, sure, once I do that, I've been on diets multiple times in my life, so I stopped eating those foods, stopped engaging in those behaviors, but I couldn't stay stopped. So abstinence cannot be the solution because we don't have the power to do it. But the other thing that abstinence does is that abstinence reveals the problem. As soon as I put the food down, I get uncomfortable, restless, irritable, discontent. So abstinence really reveals what my original problem is, the reason why I started to engage in using these foods and these behaviors. I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. So abstinence is the prerequisite, the solution. We need abstinence in order to get the solution. But abstinence cannot be the goal because abstinence is extremely uncomfortable. It's a very uncomfortable state for a compulsive overeater to be abstinent without any other solution. That's why Silkworth didn't have a solution because the only thing he had to recommend was entire abstinence. But abstinence is an absolute prerequisite. And then it has to be very quickly followed by the second part of the solution, which is a spiritual experience. Once we have that spiritual experience, then that restlessness, irritability, discontentment is gone. And I can stay away from those foods peacefully for the rest of my life one day at a time. So that's why we, in this Vision for You meeting, we talk about getting recovered. That is the solution. Recovered is abstinence plus a spiritual experience as a result of working the steps. But abstinence alone is very uncomfortable, and it's temporary, and it won't last. I hope that's
I understand helpful. What you're saying. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeannie B., for the question. Thanks to all who posed questions this morning. And, of course, thank you very much, Stephen, for your compelling, informative, and thought-provoking presentation this morning on The Doctor's Opinion. Your clarity is always greatly appreciated. Today's share ID, 22761. That's 22761 for Stephen's presentation this morning. We're going to close now from page 164. It is found in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge a road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.